Hi, I'm back, Raghu Marcus, and back with Roshi Joan Halifax, one of my dearest friends, but one of my most important teachers. I count her for many years. And Roshi, welcome.
Thank you so much, Raghu. It's always a joy to be with you.
Same. So everybody out there, Roshi Halifax has a new book. It's coming out in May. Is that correct?
That's right.
And there it is, Standing at the Edge, Finding Freedom Where Fear, Furry Fear, and Courage Meet. And I just said to Roshi before we went on, I said, yeah, this will take about 5 podcasts if we're to properly investigate everything and talk about everything. I mean, it is so rich, Roshi. It's just incredible. And if you don't mind, there's a few things I like to read from the book.
Okay.
And just have you elaborate on a little bit more. And then
I'm open to doing 5 podcasts with you.
Oh, you are?
Right?
Yeah, if I could only catch you, if you had that kind of time, yeah. But, oh, and we're going to be together, I must mention this, in Maui with Ram Dass Krishnas, Frank Ostasevsky, and Bob Thurman, who I know. Yeah, and so that's going to be a delightful time at the beginning of May. I think there may not be places in the actual hotel where the thing takes place at the Nepali, but there is wonderful places right next door, and you can come from off-site. Okay, there are still availability.
Do you mean the program's almost full?
Correct.
Wow. I'm excited. Well, I have to say that I am there on the release date of the book, which makes
me
so happy.
Okay, and you will, of course, sign copies.
I will sign copies, and it is a totally cool book. I tell you, it is so powerful. If people want to, they can pre-order it now on Amazon at a discount, but they should also read the editorial reviews. We have, it's over the top.
Yeah, it really is. And just to reiterate, everybody, it will really help the book if you do a pre-order. Now, all of everyone listening to Mind Rolling, and this, we're going to have an excerpt out on ramdass.org. We're going to do a bunch of things, and it'll really help. That's how it works with Amazon. If you get enough people interested, they bring in enough copies to make sure that anybody who wants one will get a copy. Because they're not good at last-minute stuff, Amazon.
Okay? No, they aren't.
And they own the territory. So here's just something from the book. I have come to see that mental states are also ecosystems. These sometimes friendly and at times hazardous terrains are natural environments embedded in the greater system of our character. I believe it is important to study out our inner ecology so that we can recognize when we are on the edge, in danger of slipping from health into pathology. And when we do fall into the less habitable regions of our minds, there's a lot of that, whoa, we can learn from these dangerous territories. Edges are places where opposites meet, where fear meets courage, and suffering meets freedom, where solid ground ends in a cliff face, where we can gain a view that takes in so much more of our world, and where we need to maintain great awareness lest we trip and fall. Seems to me that I did pick something that's a core of what this book is, and maybe how did this come to you? Just give us a little bit about the process and what we are talking about here. In terms of these edge states?
You know, Raghu, I have learned so much from my failures. That's how it came to me. And so it was, I learned that it's important not to devalue the very obstacles that we encounter in our human experience. And, you know, we're such a lovey-dovey, everything is wonderful world, you know, that's how some people sort of see it. And there's a kind of rejection of the shadow side. And I'm talking not just about shadow in terms of the issues that we aren't able to access or see, but I'm talking about the negative aspects. And my failures have been my greatest teachers.
Hmm. And can you talk a little bit about the different edge states that are in this book?
Yeah. So I explore five edge states, but I'm sure that we could take this perspective and actually build out even, you know, more territories. But these are edge states that I found to be really important for people who are involved in selfless service. And the first one is altruism. And altruism is that experience of helping others, serving others, where there's some kind of sacrifice and in the process of it. And that sacrifice, if you will, if it becomes too great, can harm the individual who's serving, can harm the people whom we're serving or the creatures whom we're serving, can harm the institutions that we're serving in, and can harm the institutions or even the countries that we're serving in. So there's altruism, and then the challenge side is pathological altruism. So that's a pretty big category. And I think just to be more concise, I'm going to go to the introduction where I introduce the edge states. So I talk about empathy in the book. I have a big section on each of these areas, empathy and empathic distress. And I say in the book, when we are able to sense into the suffering of another person, our empathy brings us closer to one another, can inspire us to serve, and expands our understanding of the world. But if we take on too much of the suffering of another and identify too intensely with it, we may become damaged or unable to act. And then I have a big section, Raghu, on integrity. And I say about this section, integrity points to having strong moral principles. But when we engage in or witness acts that violate our sense of integrity, justice, or beneficence, moral suffering can be the outcome. And then there's a big section on respect. And respect is a way we hold beings and things in high regard. Respect can disappear into the swamp of toxic disrespect when we go against the grain of values and principles of civility and disparage others or ourselves. Then I have a section on engagement. Engagement in our work can give us a sense of purpose and meaning to our lives, particularly if our work serves others. But overwork, a poisonous workplace, and the experience of the lack of efficacy can lead to burnout, which can cause physical and psychological collapse. Then I say, like any doctor who diagnoses an illness before recommending a treatment, I felt compelled to explore the destructive side of these five virtuous human qualities, that is altruism, empathy, integrity, respect, and engagement. Along the way, I was surprised to learn that even in these degraded forms, edge states can teach and strengthen us, just as bone and muscle are strengthened when exposed to stress, or if broken or torn, can heal in the right circumstances and become stronger for having been injured.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but I have found reading the book, because you mentioned right at the beginning, especially you related to these edge states, especially people that are doing service,
right?
Basically. But I counter that with how meaningful many of these states that I could personally relate with. And let me, without being officially quote unquote doing service, and one of them was around pathological altruism.
Okay. Ah.
And altruism, you say, that is sourced in fear, the unconscious need for social approval, and where this next line is where I got, oh God, yes, that's me, the compulsion to fix other people, okay? The unhealthy power dynamics easily crosses the line into harm. And so here I am. I have a healthy, unhealthy dose of wanting to fix other people. I think that's a very common attribute for many, many, many people, that especially in relationships, right? So talk a little bit, give us a little, some antidotes to that very pathological trait.
Well, I feel always, Raghu, that the first and most important thing is being aware of those tendencies which are, we could say, more harmful or less helpful. And so, you know, for altruism, I in the book, I explore what we call the three tenets. And the three tenets are not knowing, bearing witness, and compassionate action. That before we engage in compassionate action, we sit with a kind of openness to the whole field of whatever we're doing, whether it's the sense of subjectivity and self-importance that we might be experiencing, the institution or the ethos that we're serving in, the situation of the person or people whom we're endeavoring to serve. It's like really being open without the kind of biases that drive us into altruism that could end up harming us or others. So not knowing is a really powerful, it's sort of a beginner's mind kind of thing. And then bearing witness, it's like being in that experience of empathy. Bearing witness is a kind of empathy. It's our capacity to really open and to sense into the experience of others. And out of the insight arising from not knowing and bearing witness, it's possible for us to engage in action that is basically compassionate.
Mm. And in fact, you say, in the best of worlds, altruism and our perception of it is grounded in the ability to rise above self-interest, to be context-sensitive, and to be comfortable with ambiguity and radical absurdity,
right,
as you just said. Rising above self-interest, that would be very top of the list in my own case of seeing and being aware. Talk about rising above self-interest. This is not an easy thing to do when we wake up every morning, as Krishnas likes to say, with the movie of me.
That's pretty good. Yeah. You know, and so much of our identity is wrapped around us being perceived as good people. Mm. I mean, you're a good person. Ram Dass and Krishna Dass are good people. And it's not very pleasant to be perceived as a not good person. But when that motivates our actions, that's a kind of problem.
Right. How, talk about a real practice that counters this consistent self-referential mind.
Yeah. You know, Raghu, the last section of the book is a big section on compassion. My contention in the whole book is that the experience that shifts us out of self-referentiality, out of the pathological aspects of these five edge states, is in fact compassion. And I speak about compassion as comprised of a suite of qualities or processes that are trainable, which include attentional balance, pro-social states of mind, which, you know, my good friend, our good friend Sharon Salzberg always writes about so wonderfully and teaches, you know, in her Brahma Vihara practices, that we can actually cultivate Loving kindness. We can cultivate the feeling of the concern for others. We can cultivate sympathetic joy and cultivate equanimity. So pro-social states of mind are really essential for us to nurture. And then intention, which is also related to pro-social states of mind, but it's really looking at, you know, how do we develop moral character? How do we enhance our capacity for moral sensitivity and moral nerve, that we stand strong within our principles? And then insight. There are many practices about steadying the mind down and allowing us to really investigate our not only our subjectivity, but our interconnectedness with all beings and things. And the last is embodiment. So there's a huge range of practices that help to cultivate a quality of altruism that's healthy. That's what I mean. Sharon and I, Ramdas, this is what we teach.
Yeah. Can you just define pro-social a little bit for everybody?
Well, I think it's easy to understand if you know what antisocial means. Right?
Okay.
So, you know, there are many pro-social emotions. Things are like kindness, compassion, gratefulness, and so forth. Mm. So the intentional cultivation, you know, really nourishing the neural networks associated with these positive psychological states, which are pro-social. They're about others. How do we benefit the world?
Mm. And back to this, by the way, whenever some people talk to me and they are obviously very, very attached to their thoughts and believing in their thoughts and so on, I have a little mantra, which is forget yourself, okay? Ignore yourself, basically. Just ignore yourself. And then I see in this book, and this wonderful thing that you picked up, a quote from Viktor Frankl, who was that Auschwitz survivor, and who is an amazing, beyond amazing human being. Anybody out there, check out Viktor Frankl off on Google. But being human always points and is directed to something or someone other than oneself. The more one forgets himself by giving himself to a cause to serve or another person to love, the more human he is.
Isn't that beautiful?
So great.
He just, you know, out of the horrendous stress of being in a concentration camp, but seeing, you know, that if people aren't shrunk into the fears around if they're going to survive or not, what happens is just one opens up to a world of meaning. Mm. And Viktor Frankl's work has always inspired me.
Yeah, no, it's completely, yeah, as I suggest everybody take, if you don't know him, please do look him up. He's in just something else. And just further into this notion of self, I think the Tibetans have a self-cherishing.
Yes.
I love that little phrase that they have that really says it all. You also say here, I believe what's important is our ability to recognize when we are at risk of slipping over the edge into selfishness and to learn from the utter fragility and mystery of life. And this is also about getting too comfortable with not knowing. But ever since I've known you, and I quote you in podcasts all the time around getting comfortable with the not knowing, getting comfortable with the mystery. And that has been a huge help for me personally to really delve into that in a way that really approaches the subject of death. And that is a highly important ingredient in every part of our lives. Yeah, why don't you just talk about that a little bit? Because it really affects the selfish inclinations that we have.
Well, you know, as you know, my work since the 1970s has been in the end of life care field. It's part of the of what I do, which is training clinicians in compassionate care of dying people. And Raghu, Ram Dass and Mirabai Bush have just written a fantastic book on death and dying. And, you know, I have to say, I'm just, what could I say? Let's see. Filled with admiration and appreciation for the work that the two of them have done on this new book, which is coming out soon, and it is called Walking Each Other Home. Hmm. Walking Each Other Home. And it captures, I feel, the spirit that I endeavored to capture in my book, Being with Dying, which death is a mystery. It's the ultimate moment of liberation. We can't know how we'll die. But we can also engage in practices, and Mirabai and Ram Dass offer practices in their book and I in my book on how to set the heart and mind in a way that allows us to meet death as a mystery and also as a friend. Mm. So that, I feel, is our work to, you know, be right, straight, clear about our mortality, to appreciate this life as it is, and at the same time to understand that the final developmental phase of our lives is our encounter with death.
Mm. Yeah. One of the other aspects that there was an interesting thing, of course, you talk about empathy. And I think right off the bat, one of the biggest misnomers people have is around the connectivity or, you know, this empathy and compassion. And I think it's probably good if you immediately give us there is a difference between empathy and compassion.
Yeah, I think many people have confused empathy and compassion. And empathy is that experience of physical resonance, emotional resonance, or cognitive resonance with another, where we include in our subjectivity the physical experience, emotional or cognitive experience of another. But it doesn't necessarily, at least from my point of view, it doesn't necessarily include concern or an aspiration to actually transform another suffering, whereas very specifically compassion is based on our capacity to attend to the experience of another, to actually perceive whatever the experience of another is, their suffering, to feel concern for another, and to aspire to transform that suffering into non-suffering. Hmm. And, you know, compassion can entail empathy, but it is not empathy per se.
And interestingly enough, you talk in the book about somatic empathy, describes the experience of strong physical resonance with another. And you gave the example of Dr. Joel Salinas.
Isn't that a fascinating? Yeah.
I did a podcast with him. I was like blown away by.
Yeah,
by,
really? I would love to meet him. What's he like?
He's fairly young. I mean,
yeah.
And he works in the medical profession, obviously, and he has what is called mirror touch
synesthesia.
Synesthesia, yeah. which allows him to sense the somatic experience of others. I mean, he told me he went into the first time he totally realized this, he went into the operating room and somebody was in such enormous distress. I can't remember, a heart attack or what it was. And he began to experience that to a T. And next thing he knew, he was on the floor having that attack. I mean, this launched him into, and many of these people have a very difficult way in life. I mean, they have a lot of problems because they cannot, he has managed to absorb it in a way that his awareness is extraordinarily high, and people's awareness aren't high, and I think they have a lot of trouble. But amazing. Talk about empathy.
Yeah, well, when I read articles about him, I haven't met him, but I'm really looking forward to meeting him one day. So he was, his story is included in the book on somatic empathy, because he's one of the most vivid examples I've encountered of someone who can physically attune to another, but also has learned how to manage that attunement process so that he's not overwhelmed.
Yeah, exactly. And most of them, many of them do get overwhelmed.
And become shut-ins of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I say he's somewhat of an advanced being, because he's able to really balance this in his life and has awareness and knows how to deal with it. I mean, he's pretty amazing.
How'd you get turned on to him?
He wrote a book. And do you have his book?
I mean, No, I don't.
Oh, he wrote a great book. I got a hold of it, I guess. And then somebody said, oh yeah, you've got to do a podcast with him. So we did. He's really delightful. And, yeah, that's one of the good parts of the old podcast job, Roshi, meeting incredible people. So one of the things around empathy that I loved what you talked about, and you talked about it documented in neuroscience, that meditators have more mental plasticity and less stickiness. I love that. Less stickiness than non-meditators. Everybody out there, we constantly are talking about you. People write in or they talk about how they would like to get their life more in balance. They'd like to get more to the truth of who they really are. And we are always suggesting meditation as a process on the path that is, in my mind, absolutely necessary. And, of course, you being a Zen abbot, you will concur with that.
I concur.
You concur. So just talk about, though, how they're finding out about this. I know you've been involved with this in terms of hanging out with neuroscientists and His Holiness. Talk a little bit about the reality of this neuroplasticity and meditation.
So I think one of the really powerful things, Raghu, is that when we meditate and we begin to explore our experience, we begin to come into a relationship with the groundlessness of everything, the truth of impermanence, moment-to-moment change. And as a result of that kind of experience, you begin to see, wow, every time I lock down on a person, a thought, a thing, a possession, a place, like, for example, on December 14th, my home in the mountains burned down. So, I got to sit there or stand there and look at this building that was hand-built, completely beautiful, this beautiful bathhouse burned to the ground. And the thing that came up for me in that process was very interesting. One was, I was wrapped by in the experience of witnessing it. I won't say positively or negatively, but still, it was like it got my attention. kind of sadness came up. And then, I also then had this sense behind it of connecting with all the people in California who had lost their homes. Some people had died. The forests that were ravaging California, the fires that were ravaging California at that time. in early December. And so, I kind of connected. I didn't wasn't thinking, oh, my cabin, I could, this is the worst thing in the world. I can never replace it. It was more like I connected with people who have lost their homes in the fire, at very close to the same time I lost mine. And then I, had this feeling of, oh, I'm s this gratitude arose. And the gratitude was, I'm so grateful no one was harmed in this fire that burned my house down. I'm so grateful that the forest didn't burn down. And, I just kind of let go in through the medium of gratefulness. And so what happens is that I think that sense of insight, but it wasn't like, wow. It was just waves of insight rolling through my experience, which was very vivid as this fire was raging. I think it helped me just kind of natural. I mean, I've been meditating since 1965. So, for better or for worse, at times it's gray, at times it's brilliant. But in any case, I feel like that my neural networks have opened, been nourished in a way to help me not get caught in the narrative of loss, but to be in the narrative of the truth of impermanence, letting go, gratefulness, So it's like that. And So what science is doing now, contemplative neuroscience, is it's validating what practitioners have experienced for, thousands of years, the truth of mental plasticity. We don't know about neural plasticity in terms of our subjective experience, but we know that we're able to state shift, we're able to see things with more depth of field, that practice can allow us to open our sense of well-being even in the midst of loss. And now, you get in that fMRI machine, and wow, what we're seeing is this kind of mapping of neural networks associated with the parts of the brain that are about insight and prosociality.
I love what you just said, state shifts. So everybody that's listening, much emphasis here on the practicality of meditation and the state shift. That's just one great outcome that happens over. I mean, that is something that I myself can attest to, that happens over time. So wouldn't it be great that you just didn't stay in some negative state and indulge in it like many of us have done in our lives, and that suddenly you became way more nimble. You had that nimbleness, which Roshi just described in her own experience.
Yes.
Would be a great
Yes.
thing. Not to mention cutting down your reactivity to these things, to negative states, which also lead to further suffering. There is. Also, you, of course, as you mentioned, one of the edge states being integrity. And so something struck me. Yes, I read your book, and I just relate with where I am still caught. I find that very helpful, right, to point that out. And here's one of those things, which you quote the social critic, Rebecca Solnit, who I've never heard of, actually, and she talks about talking about the far left, political left, that they often engage in recreational bitterness.
Isn't that a
That's so
fabulous term?
yeah. I was
She
like,
just nails it. She also wrote, by the way, you should check her out. She's fantastic. She's also a close friend
oh, really?
and
Okay.
has been to Dolpo with me several times. Wrote a fabulous article about our Nomads Clinic in the New Yorker for the New Yorker. And she wrote the introduction to the book. And that woman's mind is just a treasure house. But she comes up with all these fabulous terms, including recreational bitterness, where she quotes, "The perfect becomes the enemy of the good," for example. That's one of her lines. That's just so brilliant. And she also is so clear that our own political process, for those of us who are more politically inclined, which includes me and Rebecca, that the kind of carping that liberals do, or a certain sector of feminists, or certain kind of spiritual people, sort of tearing down, the efforts of the, say, the I'm not going to get into politics, even though
Well,
I'm
I
deep
was.
into it,
Go
but
ahead.
I don't know. But anyway, the efforts of the left, just of the far left, where there's partisan fighting within the context, for example, of those of us who are not so conservative. And that just doesn't help at all. I mean, it divides our efforts to unify our country in the way of good. And Rebecca just, she nails it. Recreational bitterness. And I certainly saw this in feminism as well. Where one group of feminists are sort of browbeating another group of feminists because they're not feminist enough. And it's like, oi,
Yeah,
that's
big
just,
oi. Yeah. So she talks about turning moral outrage into a competitive sport. Okay. So I'm going to tell you, that's why when I look back on this, I actually had, made a note about it and thought, oh, yeah, this would be something to talk about. But I last night last night was the Super Bowl. Okay.
I
Remember
skipped it.
we
I
watched the
know
Super
we
Bowl
did it. We
together one
did,
year.
but anyway, yeah.
All right. So the Super Bowl was between the New England Patriots and the Philadelphia Eagles. And so talk about moral outrage into a competitive sport. The New England Patriots are owned by a gentleman named Robert Kraft, and Bill Belichick is the coach and the star quarterback. All are close to Donald Trump.
Oh.
Yeah. So I went into this, I don't care. Ultimately, my team is New York Giants, so I didn't care who would really win, except for the fact I got into what Rebecca is absolutely edifying. I was it. I just wanted them to lose. That's all.
Oi.
I wanted them to lose because they were close to Donald Trump. Okay, so I read this. I reread this morning. I went, "Oh Christ, I'm right in that ball game, aren't I?" But this is a huge issue, and it happens all the time, especially now with this huge polarization in this country, and it
It's true.
becomes yeah,
And
and just.
there's so much negativity, complaining, bullying, putting down of other people. It's really sickening. And it's impairing our deepest political process.
Yeah. And we're all part of it. I count myself right in there with it as well.
Well, let me ask you,
Yeah.
what do you think of the book?
What do I think of your book? Are you kidding?
No, I want to know.
I love this book, and it's this book we said it in the very beginning. It will take me five podcasts. I'm going to have to nail you on that and do it over this year. We'll have to do five podcasts, okay? Or I'll catch you in Maui and we'll do some more on this. There, It is so unusual in the in you bringing up these different edge states, which every one of them has something to offer for everyone in terms of the of us all being able to get at our inner truth and to become one of the things. And I was going to talk about this in a little bit here before we lose you. Is Sharon in a thing that we did in Maui, and I've been working with all of our from Jack and Joseph and Sharon. I've been working with everybody around this, which is Duncan Trussell said to Sharon, "What do you do? What's your spiritual practice?" And she said, "I get up in the morning, I sit on my mat, and I get real, Duncan." And so now we've gone into a whole thing. What is getting real? Yeah. Getting real is dealing with our projections. Getting real is dealing with the story that we convince ourselves is real, and so on and so forth. And we've been investigating this. Well, okay, standing at the edge, I have notes throughout this. Okay, this is about getting real. Okay, this is about getting real. Of getting real with our integrity, getting real with our respect, getting real with the altruism, and so on. So that's what I feel about this book. It is a primer about getting more real in our lives so that we can identify, and as you said in the beginning, whatever mistakes and whatever places that we happen to get into that are negative, that we can use them to move ourselves forward, to become free of these kinds of afflictions that prevent us from being of use to our fellow humans. How's that for you?
Wow. Oh, wow. I thank you so much, Raghu. I'm very grateful to have written this book, because it gave me the opportunity to think deeply about this. You know, I teach this all the time, but somehow sitting in the midst of each of these edge states and sitting on the edge of each of the edge states and looking into the geography of suffering and also into the geography of virtue. And, I got to think about, I have friends and associates all over the world who are struggling as they are, in a world of such dynamic change and where there's a feeling of extreme vulnerability, but also there's also a feeling of, this is a time where, in a way, I was born to be in the world that we are now, so I can really serve this world. It was a great, it was a great experience writing the book.
It translates as such. There's something else I want to bring up with you before we part company here. In the book, you talk about this particular practice that is done at Upaya. Chanting the verse of atonement is what it is. All my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion born of body, speech, and mind, I now fully atone. Sounds like Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement a little bit. The word atone is a good one. And so I was brought up, it was such a good and evil thing in my, being brought up Jewish. It's a very difficult word. But atonement, and this twisted me into a different direction, means at one-ment, not separating from the truth of the whole of our lives, and bringing the fractured pieces together is an act of brave and honest conciliation. So one of the other things that I've been working on, and I really wanted to get your perspective of, and that is around karma, because that is what we're talking about here in this particular prayer. Is to transform. Can you talk to us a little bit about karma. And I mean, many people, of course, cause and effect, and there's a the simplistic stuff around it. I actually did a podcast, Roshi, with Robert Svoboda. I don't know if you know who Robert is. Yeah. So Robert, and the third book of his Agora books was called The Law of Karma. And he really had some just absolutely beautiful, he passed along some beautiful definitions and characterizations of karma from Vimalananda. But can just in your own life and your practice, and I really want to get at how we can use the wisdom of karma to help in our transformation process.
I think there are a number of perspectives here that are interesting. One is that if we have the insight of interdependence, interconnectedness, and interpenetration, that we are in this kind of Indra's net of connection, we begin to understand something about what Teilhard de Chardin talked about. He said, you know, in the evolution of consciousness, the more consciousness there is, the more responsible we are. And so taking responsibility is really one of the key aspects for me in our understanding of karma. You know, we can't say, for example, if a child, you know, a little baby pulls the trigger on a gun accidentally and kills his parent, we can say, oh, that's a certain kind of karma. But holding that child responsible is not within, you know, reasonableness at all. So that's one aspect. You know, to understand our interconnectedness, to understand the role of our responsibility, and to also understand that bad things happen to good people. And we can attribute it to something in a past life, or we can look at it as an opportunity for development. And so part of, I think, what makes this book interesting from the karmic perspective is that it's not to turn away from the difficulties we encounter, like the bad karma part of our lives, whether we've sown it or been subject to it, but that we have the opportunity to use the hand that we've been dealt as a way to develop moral character and as a way to ultimately open up compassion within our own lives in order to serve others.
And maybe talk a little, one of the things that I do talk, and I have talked with other friends of ours and teachers about, is the level of subtlety in terms of thoughts that we generate, or thoughts that occur, and how they have a profound effect, and particularly around supporting and the continuation of habitual patterns.
Absolutely.
So maybe, yeah, talk about karma and habitual patterns and awareness there.
Well, the reason why many of us practice is to become aware of our self-talk, and to actually identify the memes or the patterns of thinking or the biases or the views that distort our perception of reality.
Just to quote a little of Robert, the comment, each of us continually spawns thought forms as we attract the thought forms of others, which is an interesting thing. Images of similar nature resonate with and reinforce one another according to the universal law of attraction. Like continues increasing like until the force of an image becomes so strong that its pressure on the mind can no longer be withstood. When it projects, the image's owner acts out the image in the quote-unquote real world.
Well, that's interesting. Okay.
What do you think about that in relation? Because now, what we're bringing into when we're talking about karma is the attracting thought forms of others. I think there's something there to it. I'm not quite sure.
Well, I was talking in the book about cognitive resonance. And so I feel like that really is about, you know, how we identify. For example, you know, a good part of the German population identified with the thought form of Hitler.
Yeah.
And was the Third Reich was really built on that kind of subtle transmission process. I would say this is true, for example, for our own political process in the West, in the United States, that we are, it's why you said it, we say it in Zen all the time, don't believe your thoughts. And your thoughts are really not even your thoughts. They're corporate America's thoughts, right? They're Christian thoughts. They're Jewish thoughts. Drop beneath the structures that have captured you, so to speak, and see if you can perceive the world and reality in an unmediated way. Okay, that's enough.
No, it's not. There's one thing. I can't leave you without you, because in there's also a chapter on respect, okay? And I know you've spent a lot of time with His Holiness, and you have got to give us a little tidbit of being with His Holiness around this particular subject. I have seen him myself. I have not been in the kind of close company with him that you have. So I need you to just give us all just what respect really is through his actions.
Well, you know, I think I told a story in the book where he's at a science meeting, and, you know, neuroscientists and contemplatives are sitting with him, and he picks up a little card and he scrapes it along his forearm and he hands it to Sokhti Rinpoche. And Sokhti Rinpoche takes the card outside and liberates the little bug that was on His Holiness's arm. And I thought, wow, that guy, he respects even the littlest creature.
Yeah.
So it's holding all beings and things in equal regard.
And he is the best example of this that I think is publicly, in a public way, of course, living today. I mean, he's extraordinary. One time in a, they were just setting up for him to give a talk, and the engineer, the guy who was handling the audio, came up to put his microphone, his lavalier on, and make sure everything was okay. And you know, there was all the monks, and I mean, there's thousands of people, 10,000 people were in the audience or whatever it was, and the way that he put his full attention onto this man and gave him that, it was like 2 minutes of absolute total attention to somebody, you know, who does this?
I know.
Who does this, you know? And last thing I'll say, which is about this book, okay? There's one word in the whole book. I have one word that I love more than everything else in the whole book, Roshi.
What's that?
Wholeheartedness.
Isn't that just the best? Yeah, that is a word Brother David used. I talk about that word in relation to him. And it's the word that I have used to translate virya in Sanskrit, which is one of the folds of the Eightfold Path. Yes, wholeheartedness.
Yeah, and if we could all embody wholeheartedness a little bit more in our lives, I think the world would be a better place. So, and the world would be a better place if everyone picks up on this book, Standing at the Edge. It really will be that. Thank you again so much. Of course, everybody, you can go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and go to Mind Rolling, and we will have a way for you to pre-order. It'll be a direct link, Roshi's book on Amazon, and help with that process so that more people will be aware of it when it actually does come out. And you can also go to upaya.org, and you can find out everything that's going on in Santa Fe at Upaya. And Is there what's going on with the cabin? I want to say this last thing.
Well, you know, I have been fundraising, Raghu, and thank you for asking, because it is essential that we replace these buildings. It wasn't just one building that went. And so, you know, we got some insurance money, but we vastly underinsured these buildings, unfortunately. So I'm just doing what I have to do to replace. And I'll be going up to Wisconsin on Thursday, actually, for 24 hours to look at a very cool prefab, because building in this wilderness is no small task.
Yeah, right.
And I need to, you know, I need more funding right now to get this whole thing to work. If we use these prefabs, which are just beautiful, but I have a little ways to go.
All right. Well, anybody who's interested in helping, Rosie Joan, I'm sure it's all there on upaya.org.
It is. It's in the donations, and you'll see Refuge Rebuild Fund. So thank you, Raghu, so much for asking.
No, we just have the, as you know, and I said at the very beginning, who you are to me is extraordinarily important in my life. Never mind just the love that we share and our friendship with Ram Dass and so on. So anybody out there who wants to help, please do so. And we shall
Thank
see you. You next week on Mind Rolling on
Fantastic.
The BNL Network. Thank you again, Roshi.
Love you.